Okay, we're going to pick up today with the declaration. We'll follow our same format. What we're going to do today is look at the declaration as in historical context first, this idea of what I call repeated injuries, how the Americans, colonists, qua citizens, came to respond to the problem before them, and then look at the political significance of the Declaration as a compact and as a plan for securing liberty, okay? First part we're going to go over pretty fast. In between looking at the sort of background, we want to look at the structure of the document too. Okay, a lot of problems evidence themselves in the origins of this political system. A lot of problems with the mother country, with England. And these problems didn't all happen at once. It's sort of like in a relationship. If you're kind of getting tired and things aren't working out between you and your beloved or formerly beloved, it's not a usually not sudden parting of the ways. Just like this relationship between the mother country and the colony sort of fades over time. And we're going to look at some of the factors that contribute to that fading and that loss of affection in a political sense. And there were many factors, and I just want to survey a few of these in terms of the record of the relationship that I think are worthwhile for us. And then we can look at this at greater depth later. Also, if you're interested in studying the Declaration or engaging in further reading, I would suggest three fairly recent books. Hans Eichholz, Harmonizing Sentiments, which is from Lang Publishers, 2001. Probably one of the two best recent books on the Declaration. Also, Pauline Mayer, a recent book, American Scripture, published in 1997 by Knopf, which is a really very readable work on the Declaration. And the classic work is by Carl Becker on the actual text of the Declaration. But I want to start off first talking about this falling apart of this relationship. The colonists were not always unhappy with the mother country. They were actually, for long periods of time, happy with England. But a lot of things happened. The traditional interpretation of how this relationship began to break apart was that the mother country needed resources. And where do you go for resources? You go to the colonies. There was that little battle of sorts, the French and Indian War, as it was sometimes called, that ends in 1770. England beats the French, and but in doing so, they incur quite a debt, and so they have to pay that debt. Where do you go if you don't want to tax your home constituency? Go to the colonies. They're far away, 3,000 miles away, the water. I think it's about 3,000 miles. Don't hold me to it. They also don't have direct representation in the mother country. They have a lot of natural resources. They haven't been taxed very much, as we know from our last lecture, that taxation was sort of voluntary, much more voluntary than it was in other parts of Europe. So here we have the perfect scenario of one country, the colonizer reaping the benefits from the colonized. Now, the recovery of this debt is one way of looking at what provokes the separation. On the other hand, another way of looking at this is that it was part of a continually deteriorating relationship. I want to give you a couple examples. By 1763, the king and parliament had a centralized administration of the colonies, particularly of America. By 1764, the Britain, England had incorporated something called a Quartering Act. Now this has nothing to do whatsoever with coinage. It has nothing to do with any games related to coinage. It has everything to do with the housing of military forces, British military forces, in what was usually alehouses or vacant buildings, or in the minds of the colonists, the ultimate threat would be to put soldiers in civilian houses. And so once this quartering act is introduced, the colonists are going to be very, very upset with the threat that it poses to their liberty. And after 1764, they will not actually house soldiers in their houses until the threat will not be real until after the issuance of the Declaration of Independence in 1776. But you can imagine what a threat the Quartering Act would have been. For example, if you owned an ale hall and you had good clientele, but the threat was that in the imminent future you might have 100 soldiers sacking out in your ale hall. That might have a dilatory effect on business. Well, if you're from the Crown's perspective, one of the advantages is you don't have to build barracks. You don't have to buy tentage. You can simply use existing structures. It's cheap. Think of an example we might be engaged in some far-off, remote, mountainous country, you know, just for example, Afghanistan. Let's say you had very high mountains, and you want to train in an area that had high mountains. If you were in the military, you want to have an environment like the one you were going to. Well, you might go to an environment that replicated the same kind of altitudes. You might want to go someplace, let's say on a college campus, where they had a lot of housing. And already existing structures. And just house the soldiers in those dorms. So we can imagine what that scenario might be like if we had to share our room or our housing with the soldier. Now my joke is that on any college campus, if you had to share the cafeteria resources with these soldiers, that would probably have a negative influence on national security. Yes, part of citizenship means you owe the state something. There's an obligation. If the state protects you, you've got some obligation to pay to it, in theory. And this is one way of defending and explaining the Quartering Act. Okay. Another act that will have a lot of importance to, perhaps more importance to some of us than others, is the Molasses Act of 1733 that had been in place for a long time. This is one that's not always mentioned because from molasses you could make rum, molasses you could make sort of sugar-like additives and other things. And so molasses were a very highly prized commodity. Now, we don't enjoy molasses as much today as folks did even a generation ago. But there's still places in America where you could find the folks who make molasses and share that. And they're really, yes. You can go to the Cracker Barrel and with your your biscuit, you can get molasses and other sorts of things, but probably to some of us that would appear less appealing than to others. I don't know about you, but I would take every meal at the Cracker Barrel, but my wife won't let me. I probably would make it through the door to our house after a certain point. Anyway, so the Molasses Act, what made it so obtrusive is that you have a couple areas where molasses are made with some regularity. The colonies and in the West Indies, both British, two colonial areas, United States, America, and the West Indies. Well, the problem is if things weren't going too well in the United States, for example, if the U.S. Or America was not producing the level of molasses that they were producing, then they could buy them from the West Indies in a normal environment. But the mother country didn't want this to happen. Therefore, they put a 100% tax on all molasses that America purchased from the West Indies. Therefore, if you were a Boston